Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to Regent's Park College this evening for the fifth in our lecture series exploring Baptist origins that's been jointly sponsored by the Oxford Centre for Christianity and Culture and the Centre for Baptist History and Heritage. I'd like to welcome to Regent's Park for the first time, to Oxford for the first time, Dr. Crawford Gribben. Crawford and I have got to know each other in one of these strange modern relationships over the years, whereby we've got to know each other quite well through emails and correspondence and never actually met. So it's a particular pleasure to meet Crawford in the flesh for the first time, and we're very much looking forward to hearing his lecture in just a few moments. Dr. Gribben is the Longroom Hub Senior Lecturer in Early Modern Print Culture at Trinity College in Dublin, and he's a specialist in 17th century matters, millennial, eschatological and apocalyptic, as well as coming up to the present day. He is author, amongst many other works, of God's Irishman, Theological Debates in Cromwellian Ireland, published by Oxford University Press in 2007, and also The Puritan Millennium, Literature and Theology, 1550 to 1682, a revised version of which appeared last year. His lecture is, or was, entitled A Radically Different World, In and Out of Time. The subtitle is still In and Out of Time, and I will leave him to inform you of the new title. So, Dr. Crawford Gribben, thank you.
Well, I'd like to say thanks before I begin to Anthony. It's a pleasure to meet him. His writings have been very helpful to me over many years. And a pleasure too to be welcomed into the Regent's community today, which I know a little bit about, but it's lovely to experience it in the flesh as well. The subject today I'd like to talk about is Baptists and Millennialism in Early Modern England, In and Out of Time. So there is some continuity with the original title. I'll always remember the evening I decided to become a writer. It was sometime in the winter of 1982. We were sitting together in the living room, my parents, my sister and I, and I was jotting ideas in a little notebook I kept of occasional Bible observations. The epiphany arrived with the evening news. Yuri Andropov had just been appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. But there, in our quiet Plymouth Brethren household in southwest Scotland, I'd guessed who he really was, and I would make it my aim to expose him as the Antichrist. Well, as it turned out, the book I did not, in fact, write had not, in fact, been destined to shape the evangelical response to the geopolitics of the late Cold War. But in reading current affairs through the lens of apocalyptic scripture, I was maintaining a tradition, the long and often respectable history of which stretched back through the community of Baptist congregations of which my family was a part. These apocalyptic concerns had often been linked to this tradition's interest in maintaining the integrity of the church. Since the Reformation, many of those who have sought to maintain the churchly distinction between the regenerate and the unregenerate have also attempted to foreshorten and occasionally overturn the temporal or theological distinction between this world and the next. In this tradition, the assembly of baptized believers was described as an eschatological reality, a little heaven, an embassy in this world of the other world to come. And the purity of its life of worship could be measured by the extent to which it reflected the purity of the life of worship that its members expected to enjoy forever in this idealized future world. Such was the nature of the Brethren Assembly in which I was raised, converted and baptized, and such was the nature of many of the continental Anabaptist and British Baptist congregations to which it unconsciously owed so much. For in our assembly, as in so many other assemblies of baptized believers throughout the centuries, the church itself was a radically different world in and out of time. And yet, of course, it's a paradox that the evangelical Baptist tradition, that the possession of an otherworldly ecclesiology, has not prevented the development of a thisworldly eschatology. And the pattern of this tradition's this-worldly eschatology, as many members of your community have so eloquently noticed, has often been millennial. These millennial believers have ranged from early modern radicals, similar to those analysed by Lynn Robson, through major literary figures pursued by Paul Fiddes, through 19th century strict Baptists described by an older graduate, Ian Randall, to the contemporary evangelicals who are the subject of the doctoral research currently being pursued by a recent graduate, Joshua Searle. This growing body of scholarly writing has demonstrated the extent to which this combination of otherworldly ecclesiology and this worldly eschatology has been sustained. In this lecture, therefore, I want to trace the early ramifications of this combination of thought and explore one stage of the tradition's gradual limiting of eschatological thinking, which moves from 1609 to the present day from being an all-embracing worldview to become a specific locus of theological reflection. I'll pay attention to the gradual emergence of premillennial and postmillennial views, and I'll argue that these varieties of millennial conviction have developed in conversation with and generally to complement other theological loci. Simultaneously, I want to notice that while millennial commitments in this tradition have changed enormously, other commitments have remained largely the same. And my conclusion will reflect on the evidence this provides for the deeply encultured nature of so much thinking about the end of time. This lecture will therefore range throughout the early centuries of the evangelical Baptist tradition while concentrating on those elements with which I'm most familiar, that is, the particular Baptists of early modern England, from John Smith to John Gill. And I'm going to do that even as I recognise I'm addressing members of this audience who know far more about this tradition than I do or perhaps ever will. But I want to begin with the most basic reference point of all early modern millennial thinking, far distant from early modern particular Baptists in space, time and implication. I want to begin with the Anabaptist Revolution in Munster in 1533. There's something deliberately contrary about beginning my account of this tradition with the event against which its best exponents consistently defined themselves. But this strategy allows us to pay attention to the things which early modern Baptists believed that they were not. So the story begins in the late 1520s, in the immediate aftermath of the first wave of Reformation iconoclasm, and in situations of exceptional social distress, when radical Anabaptists in and around the city-states of Holland and northwest Germany revived old and revolutionary ideas. In 1532 and 33, a number of the preachers of this foundationally unstable ideology of social change sought refuge from their persecutors in the newly Lutheran town of Munster. Among their number were disciples of Melchior Hoffmann, a wandering prophet who had gained access to significant new spheres of influence after his recent conversion to the Anabaptist cause. Hoffmann taught his followers that a short period of signs, wonders and apocalyptic woes would precede a golden age of heaven and earth, which he argued would begin 15 centuries after the crucifixion in 1533. In Munster, these millennial ideas were rapidly disseminated and turned into a massive zession dominating the whole life of the poorer classes of the town. Among the large number responding to this new message was the leader of the town's recently triumphant Lutheran party, Bernd Rothmann, who, having turned Anabaptist, added to Hoffmann's millennial discourse a smattering of the principles of communism he had learned from the recently reprinted, though spuriously attributed, Fifth Epistle of Clement. The effect of this combination of high and low culture was overwhelming. There streamed into Munster a vast number of insecure and harassed proletarians, mainly from the Dutch centres of early capitalism, suddenly attracted by the prospect of easy living. At the same time, many of the wealthy grew appalled by this powerful Anabaptist movement, supported by a mass of unemployed and desperate foreigners. Roman Catholics and Lutherans united to outmaneuver the revolutionary preachers. Hoffmann was arrested and imprisoned in a cage until his death, but the movement's leadership was assumed by a preacher who shared little of his quietist passivity. Jan Matthias, baker-turned-preacher, taught his followers that their duty was not simply to wait for the millennium, but actively to prepare for it, if necessary, by the violent disruption of the political status quo. He identified two visiting preachers as Enoch and Elijah, the two witnesses expected in the final days. The town erupted in mass hysteria under the impact of their preaching, and many of the wealthy made rapid plans to flee. The leadership of the now largely Anabaptist community issued proclamations which identified the town as a centre to which the godly should resort. Munster was the New Jerusalem, the only place of safety when the earth would be destroyed in Easter 1534. The results were dramatic. Streets were lit by bonfires of books, paintings and sculpture looted from the cathedral. The Dutch prophets, as the two witnesses were known, dominated public life. They ordered the expulsion of all remaining Lutherans and Roman Catholics and commanded that anyone remaining in the town, refusing to be rebaptized, was immediately to be put to death. By the end of February, the city was under siege. Inside, private property was abolished. All books, with the exception of the Bible, were forbidden. Polygamy was established. Marriages with unbelievers were broken, and every woman of marriageable age was compelled to find a husband. And then the eschatological identity of the more dominant of the witnesses was revealed. Jan Bokkelsen, a tailor better known as John of Leiden, was proclaimed Messiah of the last days, the man who would become the universal king. The regime advanced his relentlessly political religion, and Bokkelsen and his wives lived in ostentatious luxury as Munster was plunged into a totalitarian reign of terror. But the glory and the horror of Munster was not to endure. By April 1535, the town was being ravaged by famine. By June, its walls had been overcome by the besieging armies of Lutheran and Roman Catholic powers. And by January 1536, the leaders of the movement had been entirely destroyed. The millennial hopes of John of Leiden and his thousands of followers had disappeared. Well, these notorious events provide an extreme example of the enduring power and appeal of medieval apocalyptic ideologies in the period of early modernity. They demonstrate both continuity and change in the patterns of eschatological belief that had extended throughout the course of the Christian centuries, demonstrating believers' continuing temptation to find doctrinal guidance outside the boundaries of the biblical canon, and to combine religious and political hope in an eschatological vision of social, political and moral revolution. And yet, in the early days of Reformation, it was the evangelical opponents of the Munster revolutionaries who were most often doing something new. Anabaptists maintained and developed ideas that had circulated widely and been violently suppressed in the medieval centuries, while magisterial reformers adopted convictions that more often represented a radical disjunction in the history of Christian eschatology. And English Baptists in succeeding centuries would draw on both approaches to develop distinctive patterns of a deliberately millennial hope. These millennial commitments emerged out of the apocalyptic worldview that was adopted by many early modern English Baptists. In the early 1600s, these believers repeatedly employed eschatological language in their development of ecclesiology and ecclesiological language in their elaboration of eschatological hope. John Smith, whose gathering of the first modern English believers church we celebrate in this series of lectures, defended his revolutionary churchmanship in a book called The Character of the Beast, or The False Constitution of the Church Discovered, 1609. And he routinely attacked his pedo-Baptist enemies as anti-Christians. This investment in apocalyptic rhetoric was shared by others in the Baptist tradition who would have shared little of Smith's later theory of general redemption. Christopher Blackwood, one of the most outspoken of the particular Baptists in the mid-17th century, published The Storming of Antichrist in his two last and strongest garrisons of Compulsion of Conscience and Infant's Baptism, 1644, to complain of the basic assumptions of the state church project. The enemies of early Baptists had good cause to complain of their frequent resorting to the language of eschatological violence. But early modern Baptists retreated from the most radical of their eschatological commitments when they came to write their confessions of faith. In part, I think, that muting, or perhaps that mutation, can be explained by the discipline of confessing faith in the order and balance required in the genre. The Confession of Faith, published by seven of the London Particular Baptist Churches in 1644, marked the emergence of a distinctive Calvinistic Baptist movement, according to its most recent historian, and therefore took care to distinguish its adherents from the Munster revolutionaries with whom they were being maliciously identified. This document made that distinction in its contents, but also in its title. It was advertised as the Confession of Faith of seven congregations or churches of Christ in London, which are commonly but unjustly called Anabaptists, 1644. The confession affirmed the right of private property and encouraged obedience to civil authorities, whose divine institution it recognised, albeit in varying degrees in subsequent editions. In theological terms, it confirmed the basic tenets of Orthodox Calvinism, drawing on the literature of the earlier separatist tradition, and it took care to distance its adherents from the less theologically coherent General Baptists. But it was obviously differing from the evolving conclusions of other Calvinistic Puritans. In marked contrast to the Irish Articles, 1615, and the Westminster Confession of Faith, then under negotiation, the 1644 Baptist Confession refused to refer to God as Trinity or to use the three persons motif, and most importantly, in contrast to many of the most vocal representatives of the early Baptist movement, it refused to identify the Pope as Antichrist or to attack pedo-Baptists as anti-Christians. Delegates of the Westminster Assembly denounced the confession as unutterably radical, nevertheless, but there's no question but that it was working in a conservative fashion to limit the application of eschatological ideas and to corral them within a specific eschatological locus. This interest in millennial reduction was not an indication that these early particular Baptists were slackening in their eschatological commitments. The confession represented the seven subscribing churches as themselves an eschatological reality, a mirror of the seven churches of Asia addressed in Revelations 2 and 3. This was hardly a suggestion of Fifth Monarch's sympathies, not least because the confession repudiated any notion that the moral law had any public function outside the community of believers, an assumption upon which the Fifth Monarchist movement was based. Instead, the confession presented its subscribing churches as eschatologically committed, understanding their role as passive sufferers, not as aggressive conquerors in the hostile world of early modern England. But they were certain that suffering would not continue forever. The confession argued that Christ's kingly power shall be more fully manifested when he shall come in glory to reign among his saints, and when he shall put down all rule and authority under his feet. And it was therefore appropriate that the text ended with the prayer, "Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly." This was not a millennial hope. The confession's scripture proofs did not include any reference to Revelation 21-10, but neither was the millennial hope forbidden. Particular Baptists took up the challenge of elaborating their confessional commitments in the chaos and opportunity of the Civil War period. The seven churches which published the first Particular Baptist Confession of Faith could hardly have imagined the events of the next 15 years: civil wars, regicide, constitutional revolution, and the disestablishment of the national church. They could never have anticipated that their commitment to passive suffering would so easily be reversed, as Baptists took a leading role in establishing and then apparently working to undermine the Cromwellian administrations. Throughout these years, their proper relationship with the government changed dramatically, but the cause continued to expand. The movement across England, Wales and Ireland grew from around seven churches in London in 1644 to number around 130 by 1660. And throughout the period, the movement's most prominent spokesmen continued to bypass millennial expectation to invest in apocalyptic rhetoric. Thus the confession of faith produced by the ministers who gathered in the Particular Baptist Midland Association in 1655 confessed only that at the appointed time of the Lord, The dead bodies of all men, just and unjust, shall rise again out of their graves, that all may receive according to what they have done in their bodies, whether good or evil. Similarly, the General Baptist Standard Confession, 1660, who, like many Reformed Baptists, worried that its adherents were falsely called Anabaptists, allowed that the general resurrection would be followed by a period in which the saints shall inherit the kingdom, reigning together with Christ. Again, this was hardly millennial, for the discussion made no reference to Revelation 21-10. But things changed with the restoration, as the heady opportunities of a world turned upside down gave way to new political realities, in which the possibilities of an imminent millennial reign looked increasingly improbable, and baptized believers experienced increasing legislative pressure. Even the hint of millennial possibility that was allowed in the Standard Confession disappeared in the Orthodox Creed, 1678, which attempted to unify as far as possible the general and particular communities in the face of Christological error and the political threats of popery. Reflecting its adherence in identifying a negotiated centre of English Baptist life, the Orthodox Creed entirely bypassed the millennial theories held by many believers on both sides of the Baptist movement in favour of an emphasis on the Last Judgment that was shared by all. In the aftermath of the Restoration, therefore, leading Baptists from both the general and particular communities took care to distance themselves from the excesses of the revolutionary millennial tradition. And they did so as leaders from across the dissenting denominations, including John Bunyan, Thomas Brooks and Thomas Goodwin, joined forces to repudiate the radical legacy. But many of these leaders continued to revert to millennial tropes. In 1682, Bunyan's The Holy City drew upon millennial language to recast ideas of Puritan conversion. In 1688, Hansard Knowles believed he was awaiting for the imminent commencement of the millennium. And Benjamin Keach was likewise expecting the glorious revolution to be the harbinger of millennial blessings. As a movement, however, the particular Baptists played down this millennial emphasis. And when their leaders met in General Assembly in 1689, they adopted as their creed a confession of faith which had significantly retreated from the millennial claims of the Savoy Declaration, on which it had been largely based. The Savoy Declaration had argued that we expect that in the latter days, Antichrist being destroyed, the Jews called, and the adversaries of the kingdom of his dear son broken, the churches of Christ being enlarged and edified through a free and plentiful communication of light and grace, shall enjoy in this world a more quiet, peaceable and glorious condition than they have enjoyed. But in 1689, this paragraph was simply struck from the record of the most important particular Baptist text of the later 17th century. The confession, which was adopted by the General Assembly in 1689, had been drawn up in 1677. Its composition was related to the fact that the 1644 text was becoming increasingly difficult to find. Benjamin Keach, for example, who moved from the general to particular Baptist community, first encountered the 1644 text in 1691. Furthermore, a new confession was clearly being demanded by the changing circumstances in which Baptists now found themselves. Its earliest readers may not have realised it, but the new confession was evidently indebted to the approach and content of the 1644 text, even though its relationship to the Westminster Confession of Faith and its revision in the Savoy Declaration was perhaps more obvious. It appears that the decision to use the format of the confessions of more mainstream denominations was calculated to emphasise the commonality between dissenting communities. But the similarities existed in content as well as in format. The new confession adopted a normalised covenant theology, one which allowed much less emphasis on the novelty of the new covenant than did the first confession. It adopted a much less rigorous position on the admission of non-baptised believers to the Lord's Supper, and allowed that non-baptised believers could become members of particular Baptist churches. Despite these ecclesiological novelties, the new confession found broad support across the particular Baptist movement and was published by the General Assembly in 1689. This most influential and important of all Baptist confessions was subsequently adopted with minor amendments by the Philadelphia Association in 1742 and formed the basis of numerous church covenants and confessions in the later 18th and 19th centuries on both sides of the Atlantic. But whatever its slackening ecclesiology, the new confession was politically acquiescent and quietist in eschatological terms. And consistent with the tradition it represented, it expressed its eschatological hopes without any reference to Revelation 20. But its caution did not preclude its concluding on the note of joyful hope with which the 1644 Confession, the Westminster Confession, and the Savoy Declaration had also concluded, "Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly." So particular Baptists ended the 17th century with this note of retreat from millennial investment. Ironically, it was in the 18th century that these believers grew most obviously interested in the millennial question. Ironic, that is, because the secondary literature on the history of evangelical millennialism regularly assumes that millennial convictions became increasingly subdued in the period of early enlightenment. While it's true that millennial language becomes calmer, it's also true that there's little real evidence that millennial thought and prophetic speculation become secularized, marginalized, or internalized in the 18th century, whether among Baptists or elsewhere. In the earlier part of the period, it was Anglican theologians who were best known for maintaining the expectation of the millennium. But as the 18th century progressed, and as latitudinarian and moderate clergy dominated within the establishment, millennialism was increasingly associated with the horrors of regicide and civil war. It became clear that the most natural home of millennial expectation was now in evangelical dissent. And the millennial interests of dissenters could be sustained, as in the extended correspondence about the meaning of Revelation 21-10 between two Welsh Baptist ministers, Benjamin Francis and Joshua Thomas. But it was in contexts like these that the range of acceptable millennial positions delineated in the mid-17th century continued to be refined. The exegetical variety, even chaos, of the earlier period eventually gave way to the delineation of three discrete interpretive paradigms: amillennialism, with its cautious conservation of Reformation creedal opinion; premillennialism, which often retained something of its earlier political edge; and postmillennialism, which came to dominate the evangelical movement after its emergence in the 1730s. There's some evidence that these evolving patterns of eschatological commitment were shaped by wider theological as well as national and denominational factors. It's noteworthy, for example, that premillennialism was often favoured by high Calvinists like the Anglican Augustus Toplady and the Baptist John Gill, with their strong emphasis upon divine intervention. Noteworthy too that postmillennialism was often favoured by moderate or evangelical Calvinists like the Congregationalist Jonathan Edwards and the Baptist Andrew Fuller, with their strong and often synergistic expectations related to missions and revival. But millennial theologies were also expressed in defiance of wider cultural trends. Some high Calvinists, like Gill, ramped up their premillennial convictions, even as others in their denomination embraced the new optimism of the evangelical movement and moved towards a more moderate Calvinism and a postmillennial faith. Nevertheless, this popular fascination with prophecy and apocalyptic ran entirely counter to the mainstream intellectual trends of the period, which witnessed the rise of a liberal postmillennialism associated with Daniel Whitby. Whitby was an Anglican clergyman and biblical commentator who celebrated anti-Calvinist polemic, Discourse in the Five Points, 1710, drew responses from John Gill in The Cause of God and Truth, 1735, and Jonathan Edwards in His Freedom of the Will, 1754. Whitby's early and extreme Arminian sentiments appear to have given way to Arian convictions, and his often anonymous interventions in theological debate appear to have encouraged the general rise of anti-Trinitarian theology among English dissenters. But Whitby also drew fire for his millennial beliefs and his expectation that human society would progress naturally into the social, cultural and religious prosperity of the golden age he expected in the latter days. So millennial study was narrowing in its appeal. But among its devotees there could still be numbered some of the most significant minds of the period. Isaac Newton combined enlightenment categories of knowledge with a continuing fascination with the biblical accounts of the end of the world, on which he wrote more than he did on the natural science for which he's best remembered. William Whiston, Newton's successor as a Cambridge mathematician and famous as the translator of Josephus, advanced this combination of high and low cultures in his privately expressed conviction that the temple would be rebuilt, the Jews restored to the promised land, and the millennium begun by 1766. But he also identified Mary Toft, who was reported as having given birth to 16 rabbits, as the fulfilment of a prophecy in Esdras. Later in life, Whiston rejected the Trinitarian faith and abandoned the Church of England in favour of adherence to a congregation of General Baptists, but there's no evidence that he abandoned his distinctive eschatological hopes, a useful reminder of the commonality of millennial belief across the denominational spectrum. In North America, a wave of speculation that the millennium was imminent was unleashed by the remarkable events of the Great Awakening in the 1730s and 40s. In the midst of this excitement, Jonathan Edwards, Enlightenment philosopher and Calvinist theologian, wondered whether the long-expected latter-day glory could be beginning on American soil. His ideas were adopted and adapted for British evangelical use by their importers, among them Isaac Watts, whose preface to Edwards' narrative of surprising conversions insisted that since the first ages of Christianity there had been recorded no event of the kind so surprising as the present narrative hath set before us. Certainly it becomes us, Watts continued, who profess the religion of Christ, to take notice of such astonishing exercises of his power and mercy, and give him the glory which is his due when he begins to accomplish any of his promises concerning the latter days. Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly, said Watts, and spread thy dominion through all the ends of the earth. It was a post-millennial expectation that Andrew Fuller was to develop later in his writing. This shared post-millennialism advanced the intellectual trends of the 18th century when it provided a means by which Protestants accommodated apocalyptic hope to Enlightenment ideals of rational order, human progress and divine benevolence. In part, this was related to the most fundamental assumptions of the new evangelical movement that was beginning to emerge, rooted in a new epistemological confidence. As David Bemington has argued, this evangelical movement shared a uniformly post-millennial hope. And this was absolutely in keeping with the rational spirit of the age. For as Ronald Knox reminded modern readers in his classic investigation of enthusiasm, the age of enlightenment was also an age of fanaticisms. This combination of enlightenment and fanaticism was particularly evident in the contribution to the millennial debate of one of the most prominent particular Baptists, the well-known Hebraist and notorious High Calvinist, John Gill. There's been a growing interest in Gill as a theologian in a range of recent literature, though he's become somewhat stereotyped as the father of hyper-Calvinism. This typology fails to do justice to his wider achievements, or to appreciate his real significance in transatlantic evangelicalism in the mid to late 18th century. Particularly, his eschatology has not received the attention it's deserved. Whatever his modern significance, Gill's contemporary reputation rested upon his prophetic studies. His first biographer, John Rippon, noted that Gill's sermons on prophetic subjects have been of late years some of the most popular of his works, and their deserved value has been evidenced in the several editions through which they had passed. These sermons, with the two folio volumes in the Prophets and his exposition of Revelation, have gained Gill unfading honours, Rippon believed, and it compelled those who studied prophecy to admit that, Rippon continued, if the works of Dr. Gill preeminently embrace almost every branch of sacred theology, prophecy is his forte. But Gill's work was also divisive. For during the Second Great Awakening, English Baptists could be distinguished in their eschatology between those who followed Gill and his premillennialism and those who followed Fuller and his postmillennialism. These millennial theories were understood to have wider significance, especially in terms of the missionary interests the particular Baptists were then developing. It was too easy for contemporaries to identify postmillennialism and the moderate Calvinism with which it was often associated, with the missionary zeal surrounding William Carey and the emerging Baptist interest in missions, or the premillennialism and the high Calvinism with which it was often associated, with the suspicion of missionary activity often associated with Gill and the hyper-Calvinists he was believed to represent. Gill worked to rehabilitate the Baptist millennial faith by expressing it in ecclesiological terms. He understood that eschatological thinking should be read in relation to the context out of which it emerged. It was for this reason that he was so profoundly aware of the shortcomings of earlier English Baptists. In the previous century, he lamented, some good men had fixed the time of Christ's second coming, of his personal reign and the millennium, in which, being mistaken, had brought the doctrine into disgrace and great neglect. This neglect was something Gill was careful to avoid. When he took over as pastor of the Horsleydown Goat Yard Chapel in 1697, he inherited the confession of faith which had been drawn up by his predecessor, Benjamin Keach. Although Keach had advanced this confession as a modification of that endorsed by the General Assembly of Particular Baptists in 1689, Gill was unhappy with certain ambiguities which he feared could be exploited by the General Baptists, whose long-standing Arminianism and occasional Arianism he deplored. In 1729, he provided the Church with a new doctrinal statement, the Goatyard Declaration of Faith, which the congregation readily accepted. Reflecting the early moderation of his early career, its article in eschatology failed to advance on the conclusions of earlier Baptist confessions of faith. We believe that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust, and that Christ will come a second time to judge both quick and dead, when he will take vengeance on the wicked and introduce his own people into his kingdom and glory, where they shall be forever with him. But just as other aspects of Gill's theology would develop from his initial conservatism, so this very basic eschatological orthodoxy would be significantly qualified as Gill wrestled both with the exposition of Scripture and the liberal postmillennialism of his contemporary Daniel Whitby, whose writing was the target of Gill's polemic in The Cause of God and Truth. Gill's journey towards the eschatological certainty of his later career can be charted through the pages of his massive exposition of the Old and New Testaments, the doctrinal teaching of which he consolidated in the First Baptist Systematic Theology, his Body of Divinity, 1769-70. Gill was moving against the trend of 18th century dissent to reclaim the millennial hope. He dismissed the gross and carnal objections which some that have borne the Christian name have entertained of the millennium, as if, he said, their notions savoured more of a Turkish paradise than of a kingdom of Christ. Such doctrines, he claimed, have brought disgrace upon the doctrine of the kingdom and given disgust to pious and spiritual minds. But now, he insisted, in the manner in which I conceive it, the millennium had been cleared of such absurdities and represented as quite unclogged and free from such an objection. So Gill was forthright in his premillennial commitments. He argued that all the Old Testament saints, as well as new, will have a part in the first resurrection and share in the millennium reign. This first resurrection, which would initiate the millennium, would accompany the return of Christ and would lift believers from earth just as the judgment of God was being poured out upon it. The ungodly who would be found on earth at the second coming would be destroyed in this conflagration. The wicked shall be ashes under the soles of their feet, he quoted. Which words will be literally fulfilled, he explained. For the wicked being burnt and their ashes mixed with that matter from which shall form the new earth and be interred in it, the saints that dwell on it will, in a literal sense, tread on them. And they will be not as ashes, but really ashes under the soles of their feet. This judgment of the wicked would also involve the cleansing of the old creation, Gill asserted a literal, a very self-consciously literal understanding of the cleansing of the new heavens and earth by the fires of judgment. Following the earlier argument of Thomas Collier, Gill asserted that literal fire would renovate a literal earth during the period of time that believers would be raised by the first resurrection to meet the Lord in the air. By the time of their descent, along with Christ and glorified saints from every age of church history, they will be let down, millions and millions of them, he said, even the whole general assembly and church of the firstborn, to a creation which had been suddenly transformed back into a state of paradise. This new heavens and earth will be clear of all these. No storms of hail, no stores of snow, no blustering storms and tempests, no coruscations and flashes of lightning, nor peals of thunder, but a pure, serene and tranquil air, quite suited to the bodies of raised saints. Moreover, the air will now be cleared of devils, which have their residence in it. The devil is called the prince of the power of the air, of the posse of devils which dwell in the air. The new earth, similarly, will be refined and renewed and restored to its paradisical estate. With the curse removed, no effort will be required to cultivate the soil, although in any case, with immortal and sinless inhabitants, there will be no need of corporal food, only of entertainment for the mind, very enlightenment kind of millennium. Guarding against criticism, which had been levelled at Puritan premillennialists, Gill admitted that Christ's kingdom is not of this world, no, never will be. This has been the mistake of many, fancying the millennium will be in the present earth, which has given the adversaries of the doctrine an occasion to object unto it, as subversive of civil government and as encouraging sedition and rebellion in the commonwealths. But Gill's apparent political passivity actually betrayed his critique of contemporary politics. His assertion that the millennial kingdom was not of this earth proved that the thousand-year reign of Christ and his saints could not have begun, as amillennialists and postmillennialists both suggested. But faced with the daunting task of defending a doctrine which had been consistently outlawed by the church fathers and the early Protestant creeds to which he often appealed, Gill rushed to offer supplementary evidence. Like earlier Puritan commentators, he appealed to the verdict of history against the established claim that the millennium had begun and perhaps had even ended in the past. Now, if any such time can be shown in which the nations of the world, not any of them, were not so far under the influence and deception of Satan as not to be drawn into idolatry, nor to embrace false doctrines and go into evil practices, nor to be excited to persecute the saints for the space of 1,000 years, and that the Church of Christ during such a time has been in a state of perfect purity and peace, free from being disturbed and distressed by idolaters, heretics and persecutors, then may these 1,000 years be said to be past. But if this cannot be made to appear, then most certainly they are yet to come. Using these criteria, Gill roundly dismissed those attempts made by earlier Puritans, like John Fox, the annotators of the Geneva Bible, or even Archbishop Usher, to locate the millennium in the past. He pointed to the heresies of the first 3 centuries to demonstrate that Satan could not then have been bound. He pointed to the introduction and gradual prevalence of pagan rites and ceremonies in Christ's church to show that Satan could not have been bound after the rise of Constantine, when the Antichrist usurped the church, and that vile impostor Muhammad, under the instigation of the devil, arose, when the bottomless pit was opened, out of which came the smoke of the absurd Al-Quran, which darkened the sun and moon, the light of a great part of the world. I quote. Gill also pointed to the persecutions made against the reformers and echoed Richard Baxter's estimate of 200,000 victims of the Irish Rebellion of 1641 to show that the millennium could not have commenced before then. The events of the mid-17th century crisis itself demonstrated that the prophecies of Revelation 20 were as yet unfulfilled. But Gill's best proof was the disorder of the church. The church was insufficiently otherworldly, and therefore evidence that the age was insufficiently otherworldly too. There simply weren't enough Baptist churches for Gill's age to be the millennium. Gill believed that a purer system of church order would be a feature of the future. But he also argued that the restoration of biblical church organisation would be accomplished well before the millennium actually begun. Gill was also, like earlier Puritans, arguing that the millennial experience of believers could be very different from their spiritual experiences in the present age. The millennium ought not to be merely identified with physical changes, as some had claimed, he argued. There would be no restitution of the brute creatures to the paradisical state, for which I can see no need or use of. The essence of the transformation would be spiritual, he argued, with every believer glorified into the perfect image of Christ. At Christ's second coming, the work of grace in its utmost extent and influence upon the soul and body will be completed, and they will be unblameable before him, and their bodies redeemed from mortality, corruption, and death. Believers would be rewarded according to their life on earth during this millennium. They would reign as judges with Christ. But dwelling secure from the intrusions of sin and sinners, these believers must needs be blessed, since they will always be before the throne and serve the Lord day and night and hunger and thirst no more. They shall be free from evils of every kind and from death in every shape and every sort, and shall be in the perfect enjoyment of the presence of Christ. They will be holy in body, being raised in purity, incorruption, and glory, like the glorious body of Christ, and in soul, being perfectly sanctified and entirely free from sin. During the time of their millennial reign, the devil would be bound with a great chain, greater though shorter than what he is now held with, Gill argued, and with which he will be bound faster and closer and laid under greater restraints than he now is, so that he shall not be able to do the hurt and mischief and practice the deceit among the nations that he now does. With the devil bound and the wicked annihilated, the new earth would be Gill's Baptist paradise. And yet the millennium would not simply pass into eternity without the resurrection and general judgments of the wicked. Those wicked who had witnessed the return of Christ would wail and mourn, fearing his wrath and vengeance they justly deserve, Gill said. 1,000 years later, when they are raised for judgments, they will see him as their judge on a throne of glory and stand before him, small and great, and tremble at the sight of him. But this resurrection would occasion the final rebellion of Satan's host and provide evidence that hell has no purgative power. As they died enemies to Christ and his saints, they will rise such, Gill said. Hell and the grave will make no difference in them. They will be in a readiness and rise with the same malicious and revengeful spirit. And though it will be a mad enterprise to attack saints in an immortal state who cannot die, and Christ the King of Kings is the head of them, yet when it's considered that they will rise as weak and feeble, as unable to resist temptation, and as capable of deception as ever, and what with being buoyed up with their own number and the posse of devils at the head of them, and especially considering the desperateness of their case, and this their last struggle to deliver themselves from eternal ruin, it may not so much be wondered at that they should engage in this strange undertaking. Their defeat by Christ would be necessitated not only because of his power, but also because of his announced determination to judge the wicked. Gill's neo-Puritan millennialism confirms Richard Muller's verdict that after the Bible, the main positive points of reference for Gill's theology were the great Reformed and Puritan writers of the 17th century. A pivotal figure in the development of the Calvinistic millennial hope, Gill bridges the intense optimism of 17th century Puritan postmillennialism and the intense pessimism of 19th century premillennialism by happily embracing essential elements of both within his anticipation of the course of providential history and the future restoration of the church in and out of time. Standing on the shoulders of Benjamin Keach, whose pulpit he inherited, and anticipating the robustly premillennial faith of C.H. Spurgeon to succeed him in the same pastorate, Gill exercised an important influence on the gradual moulding of millennial faith among English nonconformists. Demonstrating an innovative theological approach, Gill made a firm defence in uncertain days of the body of divinity he inherited from earlier particular Baptists. Although a dogged defender of the Calvinistic faith, Gill's interests were too expensive too extensive to be limited only to the exploration of the soteriology he inherited from the 16th century reformers. The salvation he enjoyed was certain to transform all of God's creation in the final consummation of the ages. So Gill charted the premillennial fulfilment of biblical prophecy in robustly optimistic, not pessimistic, terms. But this was, as Ronald Knox might remind us, a theology of Enlightenment fanaticism. Despite his complaints about 17th century Baptist millennialists, Gill contended that the Antichrist's reign would end in 1866, that Jews would be converted and settled in Israel by 1896, and that by 1941 the Islamic Empire would be destroyed and the gospel and a biblical ecclesiology spread throughout the world. "Happy therefore will he be that comes to this date," said Gill. "These will be happy, halcyon days indeed." One wonders how Gill was being read in 1941. But these dates could not be settled with precision, he admitted. And in any case, the time of the second coming and personal appearance of Christ and of the millennium cannot be known hereby. These events were merely signs of Christ's spiritual reign and a halcyon day, halcyon age they presaged. The more near signs, or what will more nearly precede Christ's second and personal coming, are the spiritual reign. And what will introduce that but the destruction of Antichrist, the call of the Jews, and numerous conversions of Gentiles through the general spread of the gospel. Despite numerous accusations of an anti-missionary bias, it seemed clear that Gill expected the gospel to sweep across the earth. His only doubt as to when that would be, and he argued his case with Enlightenment means, driving towards fanatical conclusions. Gill successfully defended the propriety of millennial faith, but his doubts about the eschatological propriety of mission lingered long in the minds of English particular Baptists. His ideas were developed by strict Baptists in the 19th century, and they took Gill's millennialism into the margins of denominational influence they seemed content to inhabit. Others combined his Calvinism with a robust enthusiasm for the international expansion of a more general variety of evangelical Christianity. This tradition found its greatest 19th century exponent in C.H. Spurgeon. In his preaching, the details of millennial hope appeared to oscillate according to his text and wider context. But the Baptist millennial tradition continued to develop, and a reified premillennialism found its most zealous defenders among the Plymouth Brethren, whose eschatologically driven passivity Spurgeon so famously lamented. But their millennial hope was entirely lacking in ecclesiological vision. At the beginning of the 21st century, English Baptists appear to have generally retreated from any kind of millennial expectation. And among those who prize most highly the particular Baptist tradition, the premillennialism of these earlier generations appears to have given way to the postmillennialism associated with such constituency-defining British Reformed Baptist publications as Reformation Today, or the amillennialism associated with this movement's preeminent American seminaries. This brief survey of Baptist millennialism in early modern England allows a number of conclusions to be briefly drawn. First, while millennial commitments in this tradition have changed enormously, other commitments have remained largely the same. I think that demonstrates the basic integrity of the Baptist ecclesial idea, and perhaps also the stubbornness with which it's been held. It's useful to reflect over the last 400 years, the basic shape of the believer's church has remained essentially the same, even as the eschatological commitments of its members have changed enormously. Secondly, I think this evolution of eschatological concern provides evidence for the deeply encultured nature of so much thinking about the end of time. Throughout the tradition, it seems, English Baptists have expected in their eschatology, even as they have attempted to realise in their ecclesiology, a radically different world. And yet their ecclesiology has often served as a foil for their eschatology. The rather static form of the church highlights the enormous flexibility of eschatological thinking across the Baptist centuries. And thirdly, of course, we need to remember that I was in fact wrong about the eschatological prospects of Yuri Andropov. I no longer regard him as a candidate for the role of the Antichrist, though we might explore the possibilities of my current suspects in the reception to follow. But in surveying These centuries of defeated millennial aspiration, I console myself with the reflection that if I'd been watching the news that night with John Bunyan, Benjamin Keach, John Gill, or Andrew Fuller, they could have made the same mistake too. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Robert, for that engaging survey of quite a sweep of time. Time will have run out for some of us already, so if you need to disappear, then feel free to do so. But if you're able to stay and engage in some conversation with us, then please do that as well. Just to remind you that we do have the bookstall available. There are leaflets about Friends of the Centre and forthcoming events, sign-up sheet if you want to be on the mailing list if you haven't already done so. So please take advantage of what's available there. But let's engage ourselves in some discussion at this point.